2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Ever snore so loud it registered as an earthquake, or you woke up with a throat as dry as the Sahara Desert and a headache that could stop a locomotive? Well, I've had all of these because I have sleep apnea. Hi, I'm Scott Mitchell. Yep, I wear a machine plugged into a wall attached to a hose every night. Sound Sleep Medical changed all of this for me, and they can do that for you. They specialize in providing oral appliance therapy for individuals suffering from sleep disorders. In many cases, oral appliances have proven to be as effective as CPAP machines in treating sleep apnea. The lack of sleep is a serious health risk and has been linked to heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and even depression. The oral appliance I got from Sound Sleep Medical has freed me from a hose. I can go anywhere, and I've never slept better. Call Sound Sleep Medical today. Seriously, for a limited time, the first 25 people that call get a free consultation worth $200. Call 801-783-5451. It's 801-783-5451.
All right, welcome back into the Jazz Notes podcast. I'm solo right now, but I will have a special guest in a minute. By the way, my name's Cleon Wall. First up, Jazz win in Phoenix, 118-97, without Ricky, Jay, Derek, and Kyle. And why were they able to win? Well, partially because two of their stars went off, but also partially because the bench came up big in this game. And I'm not talking about the guys who are usually on the bench and started in the game. That would be Tabo Cephalosha and Royce O'Neal. No, who I'm talking about is George Niang, who had 11 points in this game, Howell Neto, who had 10, Epe Udo, who had 6 points, and 4 assists, really some nice passes there, and then Grayson Allen, who played 19 minutes, 6 for 9 from the field, and had 14 points in the game. Quinn Snyder said after the game he was most impressed because Grayson was able to actually play some good defense, and you expect to hear that from the coach, but that's also a good thing to hear because that's what he struggled with the most this season. So great for the bench in this game. And it's great that they were able to get on the floor because in reality, once the other guys get healthy, they're not going to see very many minutes of playing time, especially in the playoffs. As we talked about in the last Just Knows podcast with Jeremiah and I, you know, it's the old Pat Riley thing. You play 8, you know, you trust 7. So a lot of these guys are not going to be getting playing time. Maybe Howell Neto gets some playing time, but it's really going to be about an 8-man rotation once the Jazz get into the postseason. Oh, and by the way, yeah, Donovan Mitchell's really good. Yes, I'm gushing over him again. 9 for 19 from the field, but great shooting in the second half beyond the 3-point line, 4 for 7, including getting fouled on one. He ends up with 29 points in this game. Joe Ingles even more efficient, 10 of 13, 6 of 8 from 3-point land. He had 27 points in this game. Man, if those two guys are shooting that well, the Jazz are going to be successful. Now, granted, again, they're playing the Phoenix Suns. Devin Booker went out early in this game. So you have to take that into consideration. But again, it's great when they can. And by the way, real quickly, they were down early, like big early, with Devin Booker. He goes out of the game, and the Jazz kind of slowly make their way back into the game. And then they blow Phoenix out in the second half, only allowing 44 points from Phoenix in the second half. So the Jazz really kind of creamed it. I think everyone expected the Jazz to win in this game. So no big surprise there, but it's good to see the good guys stay hot. It's also good to see some of the bench players who aren't going to get a lot of playing time in the future and who have not gotten a lot of playing time so far this season to be able to go out there and to play well for the Utah Jazz in this game. And also one Jimmer note in this game. Jimmer Fredette, 22 minutes in this game, 5 for 11 from the field. 10 points in this game, but 0 for 4 from the three-point line. Jazz next play Sacramento, and then they play the Lakers on Sunday. I made a bold prediction. I said that I think the Jazz are going to win all of their games going up to the last two games, which are against the Denver Nuggets and the LA Clippers. I'm still holding to that. Sacramento kind of scares me, especially if a lot of guys are hurt with the Jazz. The other bad thing that happened is that both the Clippers actually lost to the Houston Rockets. Both the Rockets and the Blazers won, so Jazz made no headway there, and it's just, again, simple math right now. I don't think the Jazz are going to be able to catch either of those teams. Again, they got to hope that they're going to play the Blazers. Of course, Blazers looked really good against the Memphis team. You know, that same Memphis team that beat the Jazz 3 out of 4 games this year. All right, we're going to take a break here on the Jazz Notes podcast. Coming up after the break, special guest, as I talked about. I'll explain more about that right after this. Mike Snar is my special guest today. He's the author of the book Long Shots and Layups, Memories and Stories from the Golden Era of the Utah Jazz. Mike was never a coach or a player, but actually worked in sponsorship sales for the Jazz from 1986 to 2015. He has some interesting insights on this team, especially Coach Jerry Sloan, but just showing up to KSL and Triad Center in Salt Lake City, it was kind of like coming home for him.
You actually used to work here at, not necessarily Broadcast House, but here at the Triad Center when it was first built. How did that all come about? Because for many of our listeners, they may think, well, wasn't Broadcast House always there, or you got the BYU Salt Lake Center, or whatever it is that you have down there? What happened? How did this whole thing come about?
Well, kind of an interesting story. I went to work for Triad America. I was working for an ad agency and loving that, and I just got a call out of the blue from Manny Floor, who oversaw the entire development of Triad America, and that included Triad Center and International Center and some other things. And he asked me if I'd come to work and head up the marketing, so I did. And I remember my wife and I talking at the time, and I said, you know, this is one of those real shots, almost a shot in the dark. It's a great idea. Is it ahead of its time? I don't know. And we went for it, and we worked there 3 years, and it was a little bit ahead of its time and ran into financial problems. The owner was Adnan Khashoggi, who at one point was the richest man in the world and just seemed to be able to do no wrong, and got to a point where I think he took his eye off the ball a little bit. It was easy to do, and he traveled and jetted and partied. And while he did, the world changed, and he went to go back to work to be a broker for heavy equipment for the United States of Saudi Arabia, and it wasn't there anymore. His job had sort of been eclipsed by other people, and so all of a sudden he's on this free fall with lots of debt and lots of money. But and Triad was the result of that. It ended sort of badly. And I just remember it ending in a way that the banks came in, foreclosed. They kept 10 of us on about to sort of clean up the marketing and financial end of things. And I found myself without a job. But I was working here at Triad Center. And the Jazz had an office here at Triad Center, too. And interestingly, one day, guy named Larry Baum, who was over the sales department of the Utah Jazz, and who I'd known earlier in my career and had a chance to work with, walked into my office and said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll figure something out." And he says, "Well, why don't you come and work for the Jazz?" And I said, "Let me think about that." I said, "Is that really a job?" And he said, "Well, I've got this new, I'm in charge of this new area, sponsorship sales." And I really had no idea what that was. And I said, "Let me talk it over with my wife." I called my wife, and she wisely said, "Mike, may I remind you, you don't have a job, and it would be a good idea to get a job. Why don't you talk to him?" So I called him back the next day, and we put it together.
Okay, so we're here to talk about your book, Long Shots and Layups, and
right.
This is because of your employment with the Jazz, and you actually got on with the Jazz right after that. Before we go there, I'm just curious, because this may have a Jazz tie-in. Why was it that Triad America failed while the Gateway, so many years later, was able to succeed? And I guess I'm trying to see if there was a tie-in because of the arena being built over a little bit further west, and maybe that kind of helped it out.
Well, interestingly, the arena was sort of on the the drawing boards for Triad America. They really wanted to build an arena right where it is, and build some towers, some two office towers, and some hotels. So the plan was this massive development that would be very extensive. But unfortunately, I think the reason it failed is that it was a little ahead of its time. I think Gateway came probably 20 years later.
Yeah, because it came right about the time of the – I remember when it came right before the Olympics, right, or near the Olympics, right about that time.
And that was a much better time. There was really nothing here at the time, and people's habits were – it was hard to change to get people to come down here because there was shopping and entertainment and everything they really needed, restaurants right there. So it was just a big mind shift. And when Adnan Khashoggi ran into financial trouble, it ended. So just one of those things. It was a great concept. Just probably 10, 15 years ahead of its time.
So you get laid off from Triad America.
Right.
You end up going to work for the Jazz. What was your mindset at that time? Because you kind of talked about, is that really a job? But on the other hand, you have to think to yourself, because you're a basketball junkie. You write
right
about that here in your
right
book. You love basketball. I would think that half of your mind is saying, this is a great opportunity. I'm going to go work for a professional NBA team. I'm probably going to get to watch a lot of games, which I love basketball anyway. I get to probably meet with coaches, players, you know, other front office people. On the other hand, you're probably saying, am I cut out for this job? Is that kind of what your mindset was at that time?
Very much so. In fact, I really didn't think much about the benefits of watching the team or being at the games and all of that. That didn't cross my mind as much as, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to get into sales, into an area where I'm going to be knocking on doors all day long to try to bring people into the fold as sponsors? So I went there very reticently. And I remember telling my wife, I'm going to do this job for 6 months, and then I'll find a real job. Because I can't see working for a team with 22-year-olds that shoot basketballs really a long-term job. I just didn't understand the marketing opportunities that were right there. And once I got into it, and I have to say for at least the first 6 months, I would go home at night so discouraged because it was a whole new world for me. And I just kept telling my wife, I've made a huge mistake. I shouldn't have done this. But about 6 months into it, a few deals started to come together, and then a few more, and then all of a sudden it got really exciting, and the team got better, and so it was an incredible time, and I was very, very lucky to fall there when I did.
In your book, you talk about the Jazz when you kind of were starting out there, and you started out probably, what, mid-'80s? Does that sound
about
right?
Yeah, I went there in 86.
So they've been there from 79 to,
right.
Okay, so you start in 86. You talked about it being the only game in town. That's, of course, not the case now. You know, we've got Real Salt Lake.
Right.
We've got other sports opportunities here locally. That's not the case now, but then it was the only game in town. But it sounds like for you, maybe you personally, but also it sounds like your team even had a hard time trying to sell to people the benefits of being connected with the Utah Jazz at that time. Was that because of this team not doing so well and they were finally kind of coming around at that time?
Or? Well, I think a couple things. I think the fact that the Utah Stars had been here helped. People had a taste for basketball. They had a taste for professional basketball. So I think when they came, there was some excitement. But I think, again, changing people's habits, even though it was, you could say, the only game in town, and we never really like to say that, but it was the only professional sport at the time. So it did have sort of a niche that had appeal. I remember Frank Layden saying to some, you know, one of his jokes was, because we drew about 6,000 people or 5,000 people to the first game, he used to joke and say, people would call and say, what time is the game? And he would say, well, what time can you be here? So
it sounds like a Frankism.
It was a Frankism, but I loved it. And it, you know, I think you got to give a lot of credit to Frank Layden. He endeared the team to the city. He was a wonderful spokesman. He was a humorist, but he was also a very smart basketball, had a very smart basketball mind. And I think having him here really helped the community embrace the team.
You dealt with two coaches. You had mm-hmm. Frank, and then, you know, shortly thereafter, within the next few years, you had Jerry Sloan come on. From your perspective, I mean, we see it from the outside how different they are. How different were they dealing with them in a professional business relationship?
Well, I think Frank had, of course, a different persona. He had that sense of humor, and he just loved the community, and he was a great spokesman for the team. On the basketball side, he was a lot like Jerry. He was there to win games, and he was there to motivate his team, and he was there to make sure they did the right thing. So he was very, very gracious, but he could also be tough like Jerry. So I don't think there was a big gap when Jerry stepped in for Frank, because Frank had been the face of the team with the team. So it wasn't a hard transition, and Jerry, of course, was incredible, and Jerry's Jerry.
Yeah.
You know?
Was there any talk going on in the office at all when that change came, when Frank decided, okay, I'm done, and Jerry decided to step in? And, you know, we look at it now, we're like, Jerry Sloan was so successful as a basketball player and as a coach, but you also had to think at that time, maybe it enters your mind, he didn't do so well as a coach when he was with the Chicago Bulls. You know, he played for the Bulls, but he also didn't do so well. Was there any talk at all about, I wonder how this is all going to work out now that Frank's gone and now Jerry's taking over?
Again, you know, there wasn't a lot of discussion. It was just Jerry was the heir apparent. Frank decided to step down. The team had kind of rounded into shape and had started to win games. And I think Jerry was prepped. I think a lot of times the bad experiences we have, I think that the failure at Triad helped prepare me for the next thing down the road. So you could say, yeah, we failed at Triad, but I learned so much that I was able to take to the Jazz. I think Jerry had learned so much from his coaching, and I remember somebody asking him, well, how are you going to do, Jerry? How are you going to do? It was a media person. And Jerry said, I'll do a lot better than I did at Chicago. So I think he was ready, and I think he had a mindset and a plan, and of course he had John and Carl. You know, they were, you know, could you ask for anything more? I mean, interesting statistic, two of the longest tenured players in the NBA. I looked it up, and in terms of games played, the most games played in the NBA is Robert Parrish for the Celtics. Second was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Third was John Stockton. Fourth was Karl Malone, and fifth was a guy named Kevin Willis who played for Houston. So you've got two guys with the longest careers in NBA history playing for the same team at the same time. What a wonderful gift. And you know, Jerry let him play. I mean, I think he knew what to do to motivate the team, but he also knew that he had some superstars and some great role players around him.
Yeah, Jerry had a nice little foreword for you mm-hmm. in this book. What was he like to work with? You mentioned you have a whole chapter that's just titled Coach, and you have a lot of interesting stories in there. Especially you talk about one story where you brought some people in and to a shoot-around, and he's like, we were not expecting you. And this was on the, from what I read, this was right on the heels of Ronnie Cicely basically saying, I'm not going to come play for the Utah Jazz. And those other players that were going to go play for Miami ended up coming back here. He goes, we weren't prepared for you. What was he like to work with? Because you have Jerry, and we see him as Jerry the coach and how fantastic he was there. What was he like to work with on the other side?
He was a consummate professional and a good friend. And he realized and knew what we were trying to do and continue to build the sponsorship base. And touches with the team really helped us do that. So he was very amenable to us bringing people in. And, in that particular case, somehow the word didn't get from me to the PR department to coach. Anything could have happened along the way. Nobody's fault, but it just didn't happen. So Jerry, I remember taking 100 people into the arena, sit there during the shoot around. Now that's a different thing than a practice. That's a game day shoot around. It's not as intense as you know, and all of that. But Jerry looked at me as they walked out on the court, and I had 100 people sitting there. He looked at me with this look, and I went, "Uh-oh," and he came over and said, "Mike, I didn't know you were coming, and I've got to talk to the team pretty seriously. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to take them off the court for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. You dance with the crowd. I'll bring them back." And that's what he did. And I think he just had to set – I don't know that it was a chew-out session. I think he had to prep the team for what had happened. Cycli wasn't coming. We had a couple players coming back that had been traded. We needed to have a different mindset. I think he needed to talk to the team about that. He didn't want you know, fans or sponsors or clients to have to wonder what was going on as he was talking to the team. So he came back out. We had the shoot around. After the shoot around, he came over, met with the crowd, with all the sponsors, talked to them, answered questions, and he was great. I mean, I remember one of the questions at one of the shoot arounds. It might not have been that. Was, Coach, who would you like to play in the playoffs? And that was when we were getting close to going to the championship. And he said, deadpanly, Sacramento. And Sacramento was the worst team in the league at that time. So, you know, of course, the crowd loved it. But Jerry could be very humorous, very glib, and very funny.
So Jerry, he is a guy that understood what his role was between sponsorship and also his team. How did the players react to when sponsors used to come around, and how did they react around you? Because I remember reading in there that you talked about how John Stockton called management the Suits.
Yes, he did.
Did that ever offend you, or was there, for the most part, a good relationship between team and your department with sponsorships?
Well, I think there was. I think there was a great relationship there. But don't be mistaken, there was a separation between the front office and the team. The team had its job to do. The front office had its job to do. And we didn't rub shoulders a lot. I didn't seek out players. Let's go to lunch, John. I mean, that just never happened. They were in their own world. And John did call us Suits. But the players were very, very accepting of sponsorships. When we did those shoot-arounds, many of the players would come by and high-five the front bench of the sponsors sitting there. I remember Karl Malone coming over once. He picked up about a four-year-old, five-year-old kid and took him over and had him dunk a basketball, lifted him up so he could dunk a basketball. I've seen other players do the same thing. So players were friendly. They'd come by and joke a little bit with the bench, with the sponsors. It was really a fun atmosphere. And that was it was not a serious shooter practice where they could be really going at each other. It was kind of a light thing. So it really worked well. And sponsors, I mean, players were good to work with sponsors. And they did a lot of appearances for us, which wasn't easy. But they were always gracious and helpful. So I think it speaks to the kind of people the Jazz drafted. We drafted good people. We drafted good community citizens that wanted to participate and wanted to help the team succeed.
And it seems like that's the way. I mean, you know, Larry Miller has passed on. His mm-hmm. wife has taken over. His family has taken over. And it seems like that's what they try to get. They try to get those good people that represent the community really well. And it doesn't seem, I mean, you look at this team right now. I know you're not a member of the organization anymore, but you look at this team right now, and it seems like everyone, seems like at least on the outside, and even when we talk to them in the locker room and talk to coaches, everyone seems to really enjoy playing for this team. They may not have the best players on the team, best players in the NBA, but they seem to be the best fit for this organization. It sounds like what you've talked about, they've always tried to strive to have those best guys always working, especially players-wise, for this organization.
That's true. And, you know, they haven't missed a beat since Jerry retired and since Kevin O'Connor, who, by the way, was great. Scott Layden before him, great in the front office as our general managers. And Randy Rigby found Dennis Lindsay, brought him in, and Lindsay found Coach Q, and they are just perfect for the Jazz mold. And those, if you're around those guys at all, and I had a chance to rub shoulders with a lot of them before I retired, they are all about winning. They're all about team chemistry, building the team, and they're very smart about it. So we haven't missed a beat, and that mantra, that sort of culture that we have, continues on. I'll tell you quickly, there's a Jazz culture, a team culture that I don't think many teams have. And I noticed it when I would go to practices or I'd go to a shoot-around. The Jazz were always buttoned up. They always came in with their jerseys tucked in and their shoes laced up. And they worked hard in a shoot-around. Well, a shoot-around is a game-day practice, so it's not a hard practice. But I watched other teams come in. Some of them didn't even dress. They just came in casual clothes. I don't know if you remember Vinny the Microwave Johnson, who played for the
Detroit Pistons.
Pistons. When they came in, he came into the arena that morning with cutoff shorts and cowboy boots. So he had no intention of practicing. And I just loved the culture that the Jazz created. And I think that was it was true in the front office. We had fun, but we wanted to win, just like the team wanted to win.
Okay, some quick hits here, because you're a basketball fan. I mean, yeah, you're trying to sell or get sponsors for the Jazz, but on the other hand, you're also, you know, a basketball fan.
I was a basketball fan and a junkie.
Yeah. So who was your favorite team? I think it's easy to pick the 96-97 team because they went to the finals, or the 97-98 team because they went to the finals. I think it's easy to pick those. And maybe it's one of those teams. What was your favorite Jazz team to just kind of be around in the time that you worked for this mm-hmm. organization? I, myself, the 87-88 team always held a special place in my heart. I was a teenager. I loved it when they played the Lakers in the playoffs. Frank Layden said, we don't have a chance to beat the Lakers, and they ended up taking them to 7 games. That was an enjoyable team to me, and I loved that team because I lived in Oregon, and at that time I was like a lone Jazz fan up in the state of Oregon with a bunch of Blazers fans. So that was a favorite team for me and one that always endeared itself to me. What about you? Was there a team, you know, because you got to be around these guys a little bit more, was there a team that you felt that you were endeared to? Plus, I was a teenager, so that always made a difference.
Well,
but you actually got to work with some of these guys.
You know, I loved every team we had. I just thought we had great players all the way. There are a lot of unsung heroes that made such a difference. Thurl Bailey, Mark Eaton, Daryl Griffith, Ricky Green. A lot of players that came on right at the time that we really needed them to come on. We needed a boost, and they brought credibility and as well as talent to the team. I share your thought about the 87-88 team, and I love that series with the Lakers. And I remember seeing that first game on the road. And by the way, we flew down. They flew us down for the 7th game down in L.A. But the first game, I remember we just got shellacked by about 20. Frank came out and said those words, and I think a lot of people went, what is he saying, you know? Well, of course, he turned around and went back in the locker room and took the exact opposite approach with the team, saying, hey, you know, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to win the next game. Here's how we're going to do it. So it was a wonderful, wonderful time to go to 7 games with the Lakers with all the players, Cooper and Magic and all those guys. I mean, it was just an amazing time for them, and we took them to 7 games. So that was one of my favorite teams, really was.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't know. Again, special place in my heart, and we talked about this before we actually came on. I think a lot of us thought, you know, this was going to be the springboard. You know, the Jazz, maybe not make the finals, but, you know, they could probably make the Western Conference Finals at the very least the next season. And we really didn't see them make that next move for almost, what was it, like 7 or 8
yeah,
years
yeah.
before they played the Sonics in the Western Conference Finals and then made it the NBA Finals the next
right.
2 seasons.
You know, one of the great lessons in life, and one of the lessons I learned, is don't quit. And that was a very telling experience because, as you said, in 87, 88, and 88, we take the Lakers to 7 games. In 89, we lose, we get swept by Golden State. We win 2 games and get swept by Golden State in the first round. And I just remember being so disappointed. That was my second year. I'm thinking, I don't want to talk to clients for a long, long time. What am I going to do for the next month? I got to lay low, and clients are not going to want to see me. But it wasn't true. Clients wanted to talk. They were just like us, just like the team. They wanted to heal too. It was a tough loss. Well, if you look at what could have been done then, a lot of teams might have said, let's blow the team up. Let's trade somebody. We got to make a lot of moves here because we just got beaten, you know, swept by Golden State. They didn't do that. They stayed together, and it happened again in '93. They had a great first. They went to the. They were 1 game away from the finals. The next year they get swept by Seattle, and then the next year they make the finals. So I think one of the great things that we can all learn is just not to give up. You know, just to keep going.
I'm curious why you wrote this book. And by the way, the book, again, is Long Shots and Layups, because it comes at you from different angles. It's broken up into different sections. It kind of jumps around a little
bit. It does.
But it seems like you take your life lessons and apply them to basketball, I guess you could say,
right,
in a roundabout way. Is that what were you trying to accomplish by writing this book? I mean, yeah, of course you want to write this book and you're thinking, I want people to kind of know my story. But on the other hand, there seem to be, like, as I said, life lessons kind of weaved in and out of there that you share.
Well, the reason I started to write the book was just for my kids. I thought, you know, what a fabulous time to be involved. What a great career I was lucky to have. I want to write some things for my kids. I want to make some notes and pass it on to them as a memoir. And as I started to write that from the business side and my career side, I started to think about all the stories that happened on the team side. So I created a chart. And as I remembered stories from that era, and somebody said, well, how did you remember all of that? Well, you've always got Google to back you up, and I had
yeah,
that. But I just remembered those memories are so sharp in my mind that I started to craft those into the chapters, and I kind of wrote it chronologically so that it followed the team and it followed my career, and one thing led to another. And I remember thinking, no book editor would ever recommend you do this. But it seems to have worked. People seem to like the book and like the fact that it goes back and forth. It's a business book, but it's also a sports book.
Were you? I know you said you wanted to write it for your kids, but were you trying to kind of write it to show how you can be successful in business and throw in, if you're a basketball junkie too, it's kind of like, hey, I got basketball and I got business. It's kind of like the best of both worlds here.
Well, you know what? I was in a unique position to be able to write about something that everybody loved from the inside. An insider's view of what actually happened was a great opportunity. And nobody had done that. And I didn't really start out thinking that. But as I finished the book, somebody said, you know, this is the only written history of the team during that era, from about 1979 until 1999 and a little beyond, that chronicles that whole run to the finals and everything that happened along the way. So I never thought about that, but it is, I think, the first history book, if you will, of the team and their exploits, as well as the inside look of the front office.
Did your kids love it that you worked for the Jazz?
Yeah, they did. My youngest son once said, "Hey, Dad, can I have your job when you die?" So they loved it. They had opportunities. We had tickets. We took clients some of the time, but some of the time we took family, and they loved being there for those opportunities. They were fans. They still are.
Give us one story. Whether it's in the book or not, give us one story from those two finals years that maybe from your perspective that gives us an idea of what this team was like, or maybe even management, what management was going through during those 2 years of the NBA finals.
Well, there's no way you can describe it. I tried to describe it. In fact, I compared it to a Rolling Stones concert. If you go, you know, if you see a big superstar concert, there is this electricity there. And then if you take that and ramp it up by about 10 times, that's what it felt like during those two final years. It was magical. And I don't know if you ever get a chance to feel that again. I hope we do. I think we could. But that feeling was just irreplaceable. I think the other thing was to know is that it was, first, it's the most watched NBA series in history. No other team, no other championship series has garnered that many viewers. I think it was 25 million people that watched those Jazz games versus the Bulls. A lot of it had to do with Jordan, of course, but
yeah,
a lot of it had to do with the matchup and John and Carl and Jeff and everybody else. To make it comparable or understandable, we had 25 million people watching the Jazz game over 20 years ago in the finals. The last couple of years, the NBA finals have drawn about 20 million people per game. So about 5 million people more watched the game 20 years ago than are watching it now. So that tells you how it really sort of captured the hearts of the nation. It was phenomenal. The other thing that stuck with me and still has is, and I had a reminder of it the other day, but I think the team got the short end of the reffing. And you know, it wasn't an NBA plot or anything like that, but we just got some bad calls, especially that sixth game. There was an easy 7-point swing in our favor that should have been called and wasn't. And we lost the game. The series ended with only 4 points difference between the Bulls and the Jazz for the whole series. So it was an incredible series. But to validate kind of what I'm saying is somebody sent me an article years ago. It was right after the finals. And it was either the Boston Globe or Washington Post or some. I lost the article, but the headline said, "Jazz the better team, done in by the refs." So there was a nonpartisan writer who noticed that, and you know, he didn't have any skin in the game, and he just said, "Hey, I think the Jazz got the short end of it." So, but on the other side of that, John and Carl, or Jerry, or anybody else, Jeff, nobody else ever said that. Nobody else said, "Hey, we got shafted." They held their heads up high, and they lost, and they just walked away with, you know, having given it everything they could.
We need to wrap it up here on the Jazz Notes podcast, but I did want to ask you one final question. Do you miss it? Do you miss kind of being part of it? Because it seemed like, I don't know if you were conflicted, but your family at least wondered, you know, do you really want to retire now? Maybe it was because of the perks that you had, but do you miss it at all? Do you miss being part of the team, or is it kind of nice
you know
stepping
what?
Back?
Of course you miss it, but I really enjoy what I'm doing now. To be able to write a book, to do some things like this, I enjoy every day, and I enjoyed every day when I worked there. Somebody said to me, "Mike, you look 10 years younger," and I never thought that there was a lot of pressure. I felt like it was just like any other job, but there probably was. So maybe I don't miss that. I miss I have a chance to go to some of the games. The Jazz have been wonderful about having me come to a few games, and I love that. But it's kind of fun watching them on TV once in a while and just kind of taking it all in that way. It's, you know, I'm always a Jazz fan, always will be.
Well, Mike Snar joining me here on the Jazz Notes podcast. The book is called Long Shots and Layups. Let me get the title right. Sorry about that, Mike. Long Shots and Layups, Memories and Stories from the Golden Era of the Utah Jazz. Where can people buy your book, Mike?
Well, it's on Amazon. I have my own webpage, longshotsandlayups.com. It's at King's English here. It's in Park City. It's in. It's up at booked on 25th in Ogden. And it's also out at the airport in a bookstore called Simply Books in the Delta Concourse. So it's around. It's around. It's available.
All right. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us here on the Jazz Notes podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again to Mike Snar. Jazz fans should read his book. It's a fascinating read. It's not what I expected when I started reading it, but it's interesting. You find a lot of interesting anecdotes in there. So you ought to take a look at it. That's going to do it for the Jazz Notes podcast. Two more coming up next week, end of the regular season. So we'll have one right after the Jazz play the Denver Nuggets on Tuesday. And then Jeremiah and I will recap the regular season next Thursday. We'll talk to you next week.